And up next, Linda Moulton Howe will be talking about bottlenose dolphins stranded or dead or seriously diseased. We're going to check in with her on that incredible story in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Linda Moulton Howe with us. Linda, I think dolphins are probably the most fascinating creatures on this planet.
And probably a lot smarter than Homo sapiens sapien, that's
yes.
for sure.
Yep. If they only had thumbs, you know what?
Exactly. Well, I think that I have a metaphor for everything that I'm going to report in a photograph that is at the lead of my report tonight, Dolphins Sick and Dying in Louisiana's Barataria Bay After BP Oil Spill. This is an incredible photograph. If you go to Earth Files, you can click on that report. And it is a photograph that was taken by NOAA in July of 2010, not too long after the April, when they had the big explosion and the oil went into the Gulf. And you see dolphins that are running, diving, leaping, surrounded by this brownish, orange, gunky oil. And that's the whole point. The dolphins swam in the Gulf and in the bays where all of this oil was. And in the December 18th issue, a couple of months ago, of Environmental Science and Technology, 18 marine researchers contributed to a study of dolphins in Louisiana's Barataria Bay. It was heavily contaminated by the British Petroleum Deepwater Horizon massive oil spill. It started on April 20th, 2010. That's when they had the explosion. 11 people died. And it went to July 15th, 2010 for the first capping that was followed by another one in September. Barataria Bay was closed off by the Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries after the BP oil spill because they knew it was dangerous for people. But dolphins continued to travel through that oil-soaked water. Now, this new study found that nearly half of the bottlenose dolphins in Barataria Bay tested 1 year after the BP oil spill in mid-2011 were in what was called guarded or worse condition, and of those, 17% were not expected to survive. The lead author of this dolphin study is Lori Schwacke, PhD. She is a wildlife epidemiologist with NOAA's Hollings Research Laboratory in Charleston, South Carolina. Dr. Schwacke has been NOAA's lead investigator about dolphins in the aftermath of the BP oil spill. And she wrote in this report, quote, "I've never seen such a high prevalence of very sick animals and with unusual conditions such as adrenal hormone abnormalities," close quote. When I contacted her office for an interview about the dolphin study in Barataria Bay just recently, I was told, quote, "I am sorry, but due to this study being part of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill litigation, we are not doing any further interviews on this paper at this time," close quote. BP Oil disputes the findings that the dolphins in Barataria Bay have been sickened and killed by the BP oil spill. So Dr. Schwacke directed me to the only recorded NOAA press conference a couple of months ago on December 19th, 2013. The following are excerpts from that NOAA news update, beginning with Dr. Schwacke, followed by Dr. Cynthia Smith and Terry Rolls, here now from Charleston, South Carolina.
The paper describes health conditions and effects that we saw in live animals when we went down to assess potential injuries from the BP oil spill. I think there's a pretty strong weight of evidence that many of those conditions are linked with the exposure from the BP oil spill. Barataria Bay was one of the areas that was heavily oiled following the DW spill. That oiling persisted for a relatively long time, so Barataria Bay as the focus for our study. We also looked at the health of dolphins in Sarasota Bay, Florida. We chose the site for comparison because it did not receive significant oiling following the DWH spill. It's also a site where there's been long-term study of dolphin health going on for several decades now, so it provided a good comparison site. What we found was a very high prevalence of some very serious health issues in dolphins from Barataria Bay, and there were several dolphins that were in such bad shape that the veterinarians who examined them did not expect them to survive for very long. Many of the Barataria Bay dolphins were underweight. Their blood tests showed abnormalities such as elevated liver enzymes or markers of inflammation. Many were hypoglycemic, which is low glucose or low blood sugar. Several were anemic. Also, from ultrasound exams that were conducted, we found that many of the Barataria Bay dolphins had significant lung disease. And I'll let Dr. Smith discuss that in a moment, since she's the one who actually conducted those ultrasound exams. One of the more interesting findings was that Barataria Bay dolphins had abnormally low levels of some hormones, and specifically cortisol and aldosterone, which are hormones produced by the adrenal glands and are critical for an animal's stress response. In a stressful situation, the adrenal glands are prompted to increase production of cortisol, which then triggers a number of other responses, such as an increased heart rate or increased blood sugar, and this prepares the animal to respond by either fighting or fleeing, usually. The adrenal insufficiency or the lack of cortisol response is a health issue. I mean, cortisol is involved in maintaining appropriate blood sugar levels. The aldosterone produced by the adrenal glands is involved in the regulation of blood pressure and regulates the absorption of sodium and water and the release of potassium from the kidneys. So these are important functions that certainly have health impacts. And in some instances, if there's a particularly stressful event, it could lead to what they call adrenal crisis, which could lead to coma or even death. Many of the Barataria Bay dolphins had cortisol levels that were well below what we would expect. We couldn't find any reports in the literature for this type of adrenal insufficiency in dolphins. It has been reported in dogs as well as people and is referred to adrenal insufficiency or Addison's disease. But even though it's been well studied in dogs and people, it's still a fairly rare condition. So it was unexpected to see this in so many of the Barataria Bay dolphins. But I should point out that the adrenal insufficiency has been reported as a toxic effect in experimental studies of minks that were exposed to oil. So we feel like this is pretty compelling evidence that the observed adrenal issues in Barataria Bay dolphins could be linked with their exposure to the DWH oil. I'll turn it over to Cynthia and let her discuss more specifically the ultrasound exam and the respiratory disease.
Thank you. As Dr. Schwacke mentioned, we did perform full-body ultrasound exams on the dolphins in both Sarasota Bay and Barataria Bay. And we focused on comparing major organ health between the two groups of animals, and then even more specifically focused on the lung health and the status of the reproductive tracts. The Barataria Bay dolphins were 5 times more likely to have moderate to severe lung disease. The abnormal ultrasound findings detected with ultrasound were most consistent with pneumonia, and based on what we know about dolphins, that makes it most consistent with infectious pneumonia. Some of the animals' lung disease and lung conditions were so severe that we did consider those conditions life-threatening. And in fact, one of the dolphins we examined was actually recovered dead about 5 months later, and we were able to confirm that that animal did have severe bacterial pneumonia. So in addition to evaluation of lung health, we did evaluate reproductive status. Barataria Bay, about half of the female dolphins were pregnant, and there is an ongoing study to track the success of these pregnancies. We do know already from the ultrasound exams that we performed in 2011 that one of the pregnancies had failed. We did detect a dead fetus, which we based that diagnosis on the lack of a fetal heartbeat, the lack of fetal movement, and ultrasound evidence of organ and tissue destruction. Other pregnant females were found to be in poor overall health, so we also considered that their pregnancies were at risk.
At this point, we'll turn it to Dr. Terry Rolls.
Thank you, and I'm going to say a few words about the Northern Gulf unusual mortality event since 2010 through the current day. That unusual mortality event extends from the Texas-Louisiana border through the Florida Panhandle, and as of December 15th, includes a total reported strandings of 1,062. Of those, 913 animals have been identified as bottlenose dolphins. The investigation into the cause or contributing factors for that UME is still ongoing. The current evidence supports that compared to baseline bottlenose dolphin strandings in the Gulf of Mexico and other Gulf states, the central Louisiana area, including Barataria Bay, has experienced the greatest increase in stranded dolphins over that time period.
So what is the prognosis in general that you can say for dolphins who were exposed to these really heavy oil concentrations in the aftermath of the spill?
Well, certainly the prognosis for the animals that we sampled in Barataria Bay, for many of them, the prognosis was not good. The veterinarian team assigned prognoses for each individual, and those animals with poor prognosis were the ones that we really didn't expect to live for very long. Really feel like death is fairly imminent. So, you know, in the Barataria Bay dolphins, nearly half of them were given a worse prognosis. And you compare that with Sarasota Bay, where we did the same type of assessment, and only one animal was given a guarded prognosis. So all the others were given good or fair. And then in Barataria, 17% were given poor grave prognosis, indicating that they weren't expected to survive. So the prognosis for the dolphins we sampled was certainly not good. We're continuing photo identification studies in Barataria Bay as well as Mississippi Sound, where we take pictures of their dorsal fins and we can identify specific individuals based on the nicks and notches of their dorsal fins. And using that information, we can estimate the survival of individuals over time and estimate the survival rates for the population. Those studies are still ongoing. Dolphins are long-lived animals, so even if there is an impact on survival, it could take several years to actually be able to estimate impact.
And our next question.
In the NOAA summary of the paper, it says that Dr. Schwacki, who's handled a number of similar health studies in dolphins, says the findings are troubling. Quote, I've never seen such a high prevalence of very sick animals and with unusual conditions such as the hormone abnormality. Can you expand on that just a little?
There's disease in any wild population, but we just haven't seen animals that were in such bad shape as what we saw in Barataria Bay. Nearly half of them are given worse prognosis. And the conditions that we saw, I mentioned elevated liver enzymes, they weren't just slightly elevated. They were like twofold higher than the upper limit that we would expect for liver enzymes. So that's why we're looking at the types of the effects that we're seeing and looking at them and to say what we're seeing is consistent with oil exposure.
And George, related to this current diseased dolphin research, if I go back to March 30th, 2011, for Earth Files and On Coast, I reported then that marine scientists were reporting in January to March 2011, so it's this same time period, but back 3 years, that 134 stillborn and baby dolphins and adult dolphins had washed up on beaches along 200 miles of coastline from Louisiana east across Mississippi to Gulf Shores, Alabama. And that was four times the average yearly dolphin mortality rate, and nearly half of those were newborns or young dolphins. And it was then that NOAA issued an unusual mortality event for Gulf dolphins, and that was designed to trigger a federal investigation into this unusually high number of dolphin deaths that we were reporting about and hearing about 3 years ago, and then further again 2 years ago. And now there is this report that is giving a foundation medically to what is being found in these dolphins that have been exposed to so much of the BP spill oil. And then in my Earth Files report in 2011, I outlined the research of microbiologist Samantha Joy. She's a PhD at the University of Georgia, and she had presented her BP oil spill research into the impact of all of the oil on Gulf marine life. And that was before the American Association for the Advancement of Science at their conference in Washington, D.C. in 2011. And as she showed slides and she talked about that this, and she called it the Mikado, that was the oil rig, the Mikado oil on the bottom in the photographs that they have taken, that they found tube worms that were so full of oil that they suffocated dead crabs, brittle stars, and starfish that were completely covered with oil. And she said, we're looking at dead organisms because of oil being deposited on their heads. There's so much there, and that we were able to document the impact of the oil leak on the, at least on the seafloor. In the places that we sampled, it was devastating. Often you saw this oily mucus blanketing everything. There are these bacteria in the sea that eat oil. And when their oil-laden waste gets heavy, it falls to the floor, and it must have been falling like a blizzard of snow for months because it covered all of the sediment, close quote. This is a series of research projects by scientists who have gone to the Gulf, or in this case of the dolphins, and that the documentation on the impact of all of that corexit and that oil in the Gulf on marine life is, to every scientist that I've talked to, is indisputable. And that when she was doing her work, she said that she made one core sample from the seafloor of the Gulf of Mexico that showed a 2-inch layer of oily material that had been deposited on the bottom, and that the sheer coverage is leading us all to come to the conclusion that it has to be oil that came down from the BP oil spill because it's all over the place. And yet, in 2011, in addition to all of those dead dolphins, all of the this AAAS report on all of this oil on the bottom of that Gulf area, 38 dead and stranded sea turtles in 2011 were also found along the Mississippi Gulf shore. There was a resident there. She'd lived there for 30 years and walked those beaches in those 30 years, Shirley Tillman. And she said, quote, "It's so upsetting to find these washed up sea turtles. I have never before found anything like this until after the BP oil spill." And that's another quote. And yet we have scientists who are having to say we can't do an interview because of litigation, that BP has taken the position that their oil isn't causing any of these problems.
What a tragedy. When you look at Fukushima and the BP spill, what a tragedy over the last few years.
There's a new book out called The Sixth Extinction. And I heard an interview recently. And I have talked and reported about the sixth mass extinction going on in this transition from the 20th to the 21st century, and the killer of all of the Earth's life in this sixth mass extinction is human civilization. And we are living on a planet where we should be in balance with and cherishing the other life. And yet we seem to be rushing forward pell-mell on how we're going to get money, barter system, territory, power, at the total loss and devastation of fellow creatures on our planet.
Linda, we're going to come back and talk about this crazy weather we're having next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Linda. We call it Conversations with Linda. And when we come back in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM, we'll talk about this incredible weather we've been having. It's just out of control. Freezing in the Midwest, in the East, down in the South. LA now in that area, Southern California. They're getting record rains. Well, I hope it's not our intention experiment we did a few weeks ago. It did rain, but we did say we wanted it to rain hard, and boy, they're getting it. But we'll be back with Linda in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Coldest winter in 20 years, Linda. Everything's upside down. We did an intention experiment a few weeks ago for their drought in Southern California, and look what's happening. My gosh, it's, it hasn't stopped. I don't know what we did.
And the polar vortex is back for the third time now this winter. And for many suffering through an already frigid winter, this Arctic air flowing into the eastern half of the lower 48 states right now may be the coldest yet. Temperatures could plunge well below zero in the upper Midwest, and they could potentially last as long as 3 days, this time in some areas. In addition, rare snow and ice is expected along the Gulf Coast this coming Tuesday and Wednesday, with maybe 6 inches of snow in parts of South Carolina, Georgia, and North Carolina, like that last one. The first polar vortex blast occurred the first week of January. Ohio is saying that the damage from just that storm is about $100 million in that state, and bills for polar vortex 2 and 3 still have to be added up, not only for Ohio, but about 40 states. What is causing these three polar vortexes in this 2014 winter? The answer is a very wavy pattern of the jet stream that has allowed Arctic polar air to move far down over the United States. Weather forecasters call this a polar vortex because it is massive cold air from the Arctic that plunged temperatures to unprecedented low levels since the National Weather Service records began in 1870. Altogether, some 200 million people have been affected from the Rocky Mountains to the Atlantic Ocean and south to the Gulf of Mexico. In recent years, climate scientists report that the Arctic continues to warm up 2 to 3 times faster than the mid-latitudes of the Northern Hemisphere. And the consequence of that is that the jet stream has slowed down into these wavy patterns instead of the more typical oval around the North Pole. A wavy jet stream produces weather systems that remain in the same place for prolonged periods. As 80% of the Great Lakes have frozen and are still frozen, and the western half of the United States suffers record-breaking drought. On the other side of the Northern Hemisphere, the southern counties of Great Britain have suffered persistent record-breaking floods through January and February, and the word persistent is the key. The wavy jet stream keeps weather systems in the same place for prolonged periods. On Sunday, February 16th, American Secretary of State John Kerry spoke before university students in Jakarta, Indonesia, and cautioned that warming oceans could put the Indonesian capital underwater and seriously hurt the island nation's fishing industry. And he also said that climate change is, quote, perhaps the world's most fearsome weapon of mass destruction, close quote. And also at the same time at the American Association for the Advancement of Science meeting February 13th through 17th in Chicago, atmospheric scientist Jennifer Francis, PhD, from Rutgers University, presented evidence linking Arctic amplification with changing weather patterns in the mid-latitudes. Recently, she described to me why the rapidly warming Arctic is slowing the jet stream into the wavy patterns that allow increasingly extreme weather patterns to persist for longer periods of time. Here now, from Marion, Massachusetts, is Professor Jennifer Francis.
the entire Arctic is warming about 2 to 3 times faster than the areas farther south, the mid-latitudes where all of us live. And the reason this is important and connected to the jet stream is because it's the difference in temperature between the Arctic, which is cold, and areas farther south, which are warmer, that is the main driver of this fast-moving river of air high over our heads that we call the jet stream. The jet stream controls and creates the weather that we experience here in mid-latitudes. So as the Arctic warms so much faster than the areas farther south, the difference in temperature between the Arctic and the mid-latitudes is getting smaller and causes the west-to-east winds of the jet stream to weaken. Now, we know that when the jet stream weakens, it tends to take a wavier path as it travels around the northern hemisphere. As the Arctic warms, we expect to see these bigger waves in the jet stream, which mean the weather patterns are going to progress more slowly and create more persistent weather conditions that can lead to certain types of extreme weather.
Well, I was going to bring up the fact that England has been experiencing almost hurricane-type conditions in its winds and the flooding. The half-eastern side of the United States has been experiencing more ice storms and cold winters going all the way down to Georgia and North Carolina and South Carolina than normal. And the west half of the United States is suffering severely in drought. Is this becoming the new normal? Will the jet stream's waviness keep these kinds of patterns going forward in the future?
That's what our research is suggesting. It's a very new line of research that is really only a couple of years old, and there are a lot of people working on this very question right now. Our expectation is that the jet stream will become wavier. It'll tend to be in these wavy patterns more often. But where those waves actually set up is something that we cannot yet predict.
The wavier pattern jet stream as a new normal, that we will see that pattern more and more, and that means that whatever the weather is, it's going to persist longer in various parts of the United States or Canada or England or wherever the troughs are.
There is evidence that this kind of behavior is actually unfolding, being in a certain kind of weather pattern for a long time. This year it happened to be dry out west, cold in the east, but next year it could be just the opposite, but still just as persistent. So part of the story is, how are we going to deal with these large fluctuations from year to year?
Well, I'm curious if you have read the letter that was released Sunday, February 16th, from climate scientist James Hansen. It's an open letter basically to the world, saying that we are up against a terrible crunch period coming in terms of weather and climate. And they are saying that it is now time to support development of safer nuclear power systems. And this is a quote from their letter. Today's nuclear plants are far from perfect. However, there is no credible path to climate stabilization that does not include a substantial role for nuclear power, close quote. Would you agree?
I agree 100%. I think nuclear has a very important role to play in providing electricity and the energy we need to keep growing and to keep going. And in our country, we've basically shut down all of the nuclear research for the last 25 years. And so, you know, we have made no advances while other countries have moved forward and developed much safer nuclear plants, and they produce much less waste. We really are behind the eight ball, but I agree with them that this is part of the solution, I think, to dealing with getting off of fossil fuels so that we are not putting as much greenhouse gas into the atmosphere.
What do you think the worst case is over the remaining, say, 90 years of this century, in terms of what realistically you and other atmospheric physicists are seeing is the inevitable writing on the wall?
The worst case, you know, one of the most certain things is we know that sea level is going to continue to rise, and it's already accelerating, and it's uncertain what the amount of sea level rise will be by the end of the century. It kind of depends on how much more carbon dioxide we put into the atmosphere, but estimates range from another 2 feet by the end of the century all the way up to 6 feet. And there's a lot of uncertainty in that number because there's a lot we still don't understand about how Greenland's ice sheet is going to respond to the warming and how the West Antarctic ice sheet as well. And those are the two main sources of water that, if it melted, would add to sea level rise. So that's a really big problem because, of course, it affects millions and millions of people living in big cities along the coastlines, and some of them are already experiencing the effects of sea level rise whenever a storm hits their part of the world. I mean, Sandy was a very clear wake-up call.
Right.
You know, some of the other very certain types of change are going to be the increased warming, more heat waves, more droughts in places where they're already prone to drought, and tendency for heavier precipitation events. This is already being observed in especially the eastern half of the United States, and this is totally expected from what we've predicted for the climate system to evolve. As we go forward in time, it'll just get worse.
Right, and getting worse does raise serious questions. How do coastal populations survive? What's going to happen over the next 90 years?
There'll be more Sandy-like events, I think. Cities along the coast are grappling with this problem, how to bolster themselves. It's a very expensive proposition when areas are wiped out, like it occurred along the Jersey Shore and in parts of New York. Should we rebuild? And if we rebuild, how are we going to build strong enough to be able to get through another event like that? So there's a lot of discussion going on all around the world, really, and how to deal with what we know is coming. We know there's going to be a lot of physical impacts, things like more drought, more flooding, that sort of thing. But ultimately, it's what that causes in terms of societal changes. So, you know, when people don't have enough water to drink or there isn't enough water to irrigate their crops, then we start talking about food shortages. And food shortages lead to destabilizing governments, and it can be a trigger for a lot of unrest and government destabilization in different parts of the world. And I think we're already starting to see some of those effects. Those are the kinds of things that are even more difficult to foresee and to deal with. And in addition to our own, in this country, dealing with things like drought and sea level rise, we're also going to be drawn into conflicts that are directly the result of changes in climate in other places.
Because there's no food or the sea level is rising, and that means that a huge problem through the rest of the century, if all of this comes to be, is that there will have to be migrations of populations from one place to another, and then what happens politically and economically for people in exodus to go into the borders of someplace else.
Right, and that's where I think a lot of the uncertainty and probably some surprises will occur, because those are very hard things to predict. There are other aspects of climate change that I think we are quite certain about, things like the increasing tendency for heat waves to occur in especially the western, well, all the continents of the northern hemisphere. We are confident that heavy downpours are already increasing and will continue to do so. We're confident that the high latitudes will become wetter, while subtropics will tend to be drier. There's a lot of impacts of climate change that we're quite certain about. So as the world continues to warm because we continue to put greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, a lot of these more subtle and regional effects of climate change will start to unfold. And I think there's going to be some things that we didn't expect. And then there's the whole impact on the ecosystem and how animals and plants respond to these changes. Sometimes they'll be so rapid that they won't have time to either shift the areas where they live, or sometimes there's mismatches in the seasonality of when their food is available and when they're actually there to eat it. All these different, very complex interlinkages between different species are going to be challenged by rapid changes in climate.
And George, already rising tides are threatening many island populations now, including Fiji in the South Pacific Ocean. 50 families on Fiji's second biggest island have been moved to higher ground to escape the frequent flooding that has been damaging houses and destroying crops there. The Fiji government says it expects to carry out many more relocations over the next 10 years because of sea level rise. More than 600 villages across Fiji have been identified as threatened now by rising sea levels. And on February 1st, Fiji's president also announced that residents of an island called Kiribati, an island nation north of Fiji, are welcome to migrate to Fiji as sea levels rise, and they are now worrying that there's going to be a complete drowning of the island nation, which consists of 100,000 people that currently live on 33 islands that are right at sea level. And the question that has been debated a lot, if the Arctic is warming up 2 to 3 times faster than the rest of the Earth, why has there been a 13-year pause in global surface warming? Mm-hmm. Well, recently in Nature Climate Change, the February 26th issue, there was a fascinating article about surface global warming has stalled since around 2000 because there has been a recent strengthening of the what's called the Pacific trade winds. And as the Pacific trade winds have increased in their speed, they are increasing the movement of heat from the surface of the world's oceans down into the depths. And that means Earth's deep waters have been absorbing the increasing global warming, which has slowed most surface warming. But the lead scientist on this particular just published work, Professor Matthew England, who is the chief investigator at the ARC Center of Excellence for Climate System Science in the UK, he concluded in his comments concerning this new finding, quote, "But the heat uptake in the oceans is by no means permanent, and that when the trade wind strengths return to normal, as it inevitably will, our research suggests heat will quickly accumulate in the atmosphere. So global temperatures look set to rise rapidly out of this hiatus." And essentially the hiatus is because the oceans have been absorbing the heat, and that it will return to the levels projected within as little as a decade. So that is the first really solid data that answers the question of why have we not been seeing, or why has there been a lull in what was a rapid increase in average global surface temperature. And now, if this is all true, we're going to see it spike again in the next 10 years.
It is truly one of those incredible moments. It's good to be alive, Linda. It's great to witness all this, but at the same time, it's a roller coaster, isn't it?
Yes. It is, and it is concerning. I started to say scary, but concerning that we are on a planet where nations are still fighting each other over so many things, and right now we all need to be allied about how to preserve energy and to go forward into a future without wasting it and polluting our atmosphere and our water.
You can track Linda, of course. Go to her website, earthfiles.com. You can email her as well at earthfiles@earthfiles.com. She's also an accomplished author, An Alien Harvest, Glimpses of Other Realities, and Mysterious Lights and Crop Circles. When we come back with her in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM, we'll take your phone calls, perhaps your story ideas, your tips. And I want to ask her a couple things to get a reaction to the jet stream. I fly a lot, as you know, and the turbulence has been unbelievable. And then HAARP. What does HAARP have to do with all this weather? Let's find out from her on Coast to Coast AM.